Welcome to SD Europe's podcast. My name is Luke Cox. I lead SD Europe's communications, and today we continue our For a Better Football podcast mini-series. So far in this podcast series, we have spoken to representatives of the players, the leagues, the clubs, and of course the supporters. So in this episode, we speak to Alexander Seferin, the president of UEFA, the governing body of football in Europe. This interview comes at a time when the world is in transition. There is a lot at stake. Across Europe, democracy is threatened even further as a result of COVID-19. There is less inclusion, less transparency, and less involvement in decision-making. We all agree football has a responsibility in facing the challenges ahead of us. We must collectively ask the question, how can football make an impact in making societies more inclusive, equal, fair, peaceful, and sustainable in what seems at times an increasingly divided world? So Alexander, thank you ever so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Alexander, I was going to say, funnily enough, when I was growing up, one of my favourite players was from Slovenia. In England, I support a team called West Brom, and we used to have a player called Robert Corrin, and he was a fantastic midfielder. I don't know if you remember him. I think he's a second division manager now, isn't he, back in Slovenia?
Thank you for inviting me. I know him very well. We even played some veterans football together, and I think he will become the under-17 national team coach in a few days.
Oh, really? Oh, well,
he's proposed, and he was a great player and the captain of our team. I was the president of the federation when he was playing, so I know him very well.
Yeah, as
great
I said,
player and great man.
So to kick things off, could you share with us what the impact of COVID-19 has meant for UEFA right now, and what the three main challenges have been for the organisation?
Look, first of all, I cannot remember a more challenging time for football or for the society since the Second World War, probably, but we were not alive then yet. Nobody in the world have predicted at the beginning of the year what can happen in March. And we had to make some very, very tough decisions. We had to save what is possible to save. I am an optimist by nature, and I do think that every situation like this can be a possibility to become stronger, smarter in the future. Since we are speaking with you, it's a perfect possibility to see how important fans are, which some might forgot from time to time. Football without fans is no football. It's so sad that it's hard to believe. About our priorities or challenges, if I joke a bit, we have three challenges. It's health, health, and health. For now, we want to get the old good football back. We wait for the vaccines. We have a tough protocol allowing us to play football matches. You have to know that we played more than 1,000 international matches below UEFA's umbrella, and only 1% of the players were positive. You don't see any other industry in the world that is as safe as football. And we think that our decision to postpone the Euro was crucial. Our decision was made when we didn't know yet if the pandemic would last till June, July. So we had to act fast because we knew that if the national leagues don't finish, this would harm football heavily. And the decision was right. And since then, that's one of the positives although speaking about being positive is not it's not good anymore in these days. A good thing about it is that European football showed complete unity. That since then, we agreed with the leagues, with clubs, and national associations about everything. So every bad situation has its good sides. Why is it important to continue our competition? People that don't know the work of UEFA say, it's only about money. You just want to get money, and it's not about football. It's not about fans. It's exactly about football and about fans. Of course, there's no comparison, and we have to bring back the fans as soon as possible. But this is a very important sign of optimism. If you are locked home, at least you can watch football, which is an optimistic event, which brings positive energy. That's one point of view. The second point of view is that what many people don't know, UEFA distributes back to the game 90% of all the revenues, more than 90% even. And that's why without continuing the season, it would harm European football, and European football is world football, heavily.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there. You know, whilst people have to stay at home, you know, just to have, you know, just to be able to watch football on the television, it's an element of escapism that's really important at such a tough time, isn't it? So moving on to the next question, we wanted to talk about the action UEFA agreed to tackle the effects of the pandemic. Clubs across the continent, whether small or big, are suffering from the lack of income related to the pandemic. Can you give us an insight into the impact COVID-19 has had and is having on the clubs participating in your competitions? And how and with who did UEFA discuss how to support these clubs?
The final impact will be known when the pandemic stops. For now, it's hard to say, it's hard to know the exact numbers because we still don't know when the football will become normal again. At UEFA, we realized very quickly that we needed to act fast due to this COVID-19 situation. So in April, we released more than 220 million euros to help our 55 member associations because they had to meet the challenges they were facing. And that was funding from our so-called hat-trick program. It's program mainly for infrastructure, but this time we allowed the associations to use it to try to minimize the effect of the pandemic. As I said before, to our club competitions, we distribute exactly 93.5% of all the revenues. So that's how we helped the clubs. Given the exceptional circumstances, we decided to allow each association to set their own priorities. And that was very important because they had serious financial problems without spectators and other revenues. In June, our executive committee also agreed to introduce temporary measures to the financial fair play rules in order to take into account the adverse effect that COVID-19 has had on clubs around Europe. I think we made some very responsible decisions. Not all the decisions were right, as always, but all in all, we came out of this terrible COVID crisis alive, and we will get back the good old football with spectators on the stadiums very soon. I'm sure that it's a matter of a couple of months.
Fingers crossed and hopefully. I think you mentioned some important statistics there, which you know, perhaps a lot of supporters won't have been aware of. And your answer leads very nicely into the next question. So clubs at all levels are faced with very difficult realities now. We at SD Europe believe that solidarity is key, and it is now time to be more progressive and focus more on the we rather than the I. The threat of a European Super League and the growing gap between the big and the small clubs and leagues is a concern and threatens the integrity of 140 years of the European model of sporting competition. You have been very outspoken about this in the past. Whilst we understand that the easing of financial fair play rules will give more financial breathing room to most clubs involved in UEFA competitions, we at SD Europe also believe that those clubs who enjoy the luxury of significantly wealthy owners should not necessarily be included in the relaxation of these rules, as it could run the danger of further damaging the competitive balance of UEFA competitions. Is UEFA taking any specific measures to avoid such a situation?
This is a long question.
Would you like me to rephrase?
I'm joking, but many topics in one question. So I have said many times, you probably know, that UEFA and me personally strongly oppose Super League. The principles of solidarity, promotion, relegation, open leagues are non-negotiable for us. And this exactly is what makes European football work. It works because of solidarity. It works. Look, not all the big clubs from big countries have players raised in their clubs. They have players that are raised in many clubs around Europe, and that's exactly because of European sports model. And we can't destroy everything in football because of some greedy needs of one or two clubs in Europe. On top of it, a competition of 12, 24 clubs, all every year the same ones, would be terribly boring. You shouldn't forget that the brand of Champions League, Europa League, Premier League if you want, Bundesliga, La Liga, Serie A, those are brands that were built for decades. And the ones who think that they can play some competition and just become a brand overnight are terribly wrong. And here, as I said, we will not negotiate at all. No Super League will happen in Europe, because that would be a killer of football. In regards to the FFP, financial fair play, I said many times, clubs still have to follow the rules. These temporary measures were not introduced to give clubs carte blanche to spend whatever they want. No way. But while the assessment for the financial year of 2020 has been postponed for one season, it will be assessed together with the financial year for 2021. And this means that clubs still have to ensure they are playing by the book. And it's as tough for the big ones as for the small ones. So these temporary measures were set up to give clubs some breathing space, because the situation is not ideal. And they are in trouble, majority of them. So, you know, as I said before, back in January, we could never, ever have dreamed of the difficulties the football stakeholders across all levels would face over the coming months. You know, ticket revenues, that doesn't exist. So broadcast contracts, some cases or majority of cases, they took a hit as well. Broadcasters wanted to lower the contracts because of less matches, which was a big hit. So I think it's very important to address the actual problem, which is a revenue shortfall due to this COVID-19. And these problems have not been caused by financial mismanagement. It's a force majeure.
I think you make a really good point there. Nobody saw this coming at all. So it has been a huge shock for the whole industry, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, who could ever have envisaged a situation where stadiums have to be empty, you know, throughout the continent for football matches to go on? So moving on to the next question, Alexander. What is UEFA proposing to do to help the professional clubs outside of its competitions in order to not worsen the competitive balance situation? And should we expect any help for the lower division football clubs that are dependent on their local communities and volunteers to survive?
Look, with UEFA's huge distribution of the revenue from our competition, it remains, of course, vital for the health of the game throughout Europe at every level that we complete our own club international matches. We have to do it. You have to know, and you know, I'm sure, we operate one of the largest solidarity payment distribution systems in the world of football, not just world of football, in the world. For clubs who do not qualify for the group stages in UEFA Champions League and UEFA Europa League. When a club from a country qualifies to our competition, the other clubs get money for their youth development. And the total solidarity payments distributed to non-UEFA competition participants for youth development in the last decade exceeds 1 billion euros. And on annual basis, has more than tripled in the last 10 years. So it was 43 million euros in the season 2008-2009 to 139 million in 2018-2019. So a total of 1,600 different clubs have received funds from UEFA Solidarity Program in the last decade. So while the money is in principle for equal distribution among all top division clubs not involved in the UEFA Champions League or UEFA Europa League group stages, national associations, and that's also important, are free to propose the inclusion of lower division clubs or alternative distribution criteria, provided it still goes towards the development of youth training. So this is a big solidarity tool. Of course, with cooperation with national associations. And I understand also that national associations, in a way, are in a tough position. Because, to be honest, never enough money. So if they propose that they distribute these solidarity funds to lower divisions, then the first division is mad. If they do vice versa, they say you don't develop the lower division. So it's a kind of a circle that you never come out with everyone happy. But we are really trying to do our best. And I said many times, if European Union would work as UEFA, life in Europe would be much happier.
Yeah, you know, I think the important thing about, you know, that question I've asked there is that I imagine a lot of supporters, you know, people in the football world in general may not actually know about these solidarity mechanisms that UEFA mm-hmm. have in place. So I think it will be, you know, I think, you know, that'll surprise quite a lot of people who will not have known about that, to be honest. So moving away from that particular topic, many member organisations, whether in football or in other sectors, are faced with specific challenges around a decrease in resources, less interaction and less activism. What are the challenges you experience as a member association yourself in this regard?
Yeah, first of all, about the fact that, or the question that I was answering before, it's true what you said, that majority of the people don't know how much or what is the percentage of the revenues that UEFA distributes back into the game, directly to the game. The remainder, so we distribute 93%. Then the remainder UEFA keeps for solidarity payments and for administrative costs, such as VAR, appointment of referees and delegates. The same is true for the UEFA Euro. Since its introduction in 2004, I think, yes, 2004, we have made 2.6 billion euros available to our member associations. So the program has helped to build 34 of the 55 national team training centers. and up to 60% of national stadiums in Europe have partially been funded by hat-trick money. And you know, while some people criticize UEFA, as we are these days, we criticize everything. UEFA is playing national team matches. Why people are criticizing, not people so much, but some club managers maybe. Why is UEFA playing national team matches? It's a contagious calendar. You know, everybody should understand that without those matches, more than 50% of national associations would be close to bankruptcy. And that would mean death of football. It's all interconnected. We're all in one ecosystem. And we have to understand each other. We have to support each other. And you know, football is probably the only product in the world that that Europe is by far the best. We have great culture, we have great history, but from products, for sure football is a number one European product, but only till we are united, only till we respect the European sports model. That means promotion, relegation, national leagues, and European competition. And only till the moment that we still distribute solidarity and help everyone.
Well, again, you know, I think you make a really good point there. Again, something perhaps people may not consider is that, you know, there's a lot of maybe dependency is the wrong word, but there's a lot of working together throughout, say, the football ecosystem. You know, national associations need these games to happen. UEFA needs them to progress tournaments. It's all connected, and
And it's enough. It's enough space for everyone. We don't cannibalize each other. We have to work together. We have to build the product. We have to stay together, and we are unbeatable.
So thank you. So moving on from there, onto the relationship that UEFA and SD Europe have had. Over the last decade, the two organisations have worked together. There have been differences on some areas, but we have a common understanding on the significance of supporters and seem to have found a way to improve the understanding about fan cultures in numerous countries and to provide support to fan organisations and national associations alike. Together, we are implementing supporter liaison offices at clubs across Europe and training them. How do you value the cooperation between SD Europe and UEFA?
Look, the two most important things in football are the players and the fans. We all know that. Everyone else, including ourselves, the football administrators, are support team to make it work. So we absolutely welcome the SD Europe initiative to increase support and involvement in the running of football clubs and football institutions, because it's vital to listen to the interest of the fans, and SD Europe plays a vital role in giving supporters a voice, because it's hard to listen to a non-organized groups. It's hard to listen to every fan separately, because that would mean a complete chaos. For over a decade, clubs taking part in our competitions are required to appoint support and liaison officers. And this helps to act as an important bridge between the clubs and their fans. You know, it enables dialogue and communication, which of course helps build trust. The trust is never perfect, but we have to try to make it as close to perfect as possible. And I'm honestly delighted that we embarked on a partnership with SD Europe earlier in the year to train new supporter liaison officers through our supporter liaison officer education program. It's an important thing, and this can help to raise standards and increase safety and security at matches, as well as helping to increase trust. And as I said before, it's even more clear to us now when we have matches without fans.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. And you know, moving on slightly from there, further on supporter involvement, one of SD Europe's projects called Kickoff, we'll see fans and FAs working together for the first time to explore the issue of structured supporter representatives and representation in football's bodies. How do you see supporter involvement in decision-making going forwards?
Look, the Erasmus Plus funded project Kickoff is a very timely initiative, I would say, trying to improve the relations between supporter groups and national associations. This cooperation should be strong. It's about security, it's about the enjoyment of the match, and of course it's also about fight against all the discriminations. Only fans and associations together with governments can try to solve this big problem. I think it's very important that national associations and supporters are as key stakeholders, and they have common grounds to build on, as they both would like to see their team perform well. They have mutual interest. They are natural allies, I would say. So the spicy ingredients are mutual respect, dialogue, and a balanced participation in the decision-making process. And we will work on that with our national associations. It's in the interest of national associations, fans, players, and society. But mainly it's in the interest of football.
Absolutely, and you know, it's like you said, you know, a moment before, players and supporters are two of the most important stakeholders, and trying to sort of formalize, you know, a way to represent those voices is very important, isn't it? So we're on to the second to last question now. I thank you for your patience going through these with me. So we're almost there now. So UEFA not just cooperates with SD Europe, but also, of course, other fan organisations. There's Football Supporters Europe, and there's the Centre for Access to Football in Europe too. You also said in the past how important supporters are for football, and that UEFA will do anything it can to get fans back into stadiums. But to dig a little deeper into that, you were elected as president on the basis of implementing good governance at UEFA. Already we have seen very positive changes with clubs and leagues represented on the executive committee, and the criteria of who can have a place on the exco has tightened. So to encourage greater transparency and good governance, do you envisage a future for European football where supporter representatives are involved in decision making at the highest level?
Look, all members of the executive committee are football fans. That goes without saying. We have been working closely with fan organizations for a number of years in order to give fans a voice. I think fans have a voice. We have invited fan groups to Nyon, you know that, in order to hear their views, to discuss this in an open and transparent manner. We have also taken action when it is needed in response to representations from fans. We introduced regulations in 2019 to ensure that away fans would not have to pay more than 70 euros in the UEFA Champions League and 45 euros in the UEFA Europa League. So those are some moves. I still think that we should, and we will think this spring, about including fans representatives at least in some of the UEFA committees. Because UEFA committees are a decision-making or decision proposing bodies. And 95% of the proposals of UEFA committees goes unanimously through the executive committee. I can for sure promise that fans will be more and more involved into the decision making process. Where we have a challenge, let's say, is how do you choose the fans that will represent the fans in Europe, because the football world is sometimes strange. And that goes also, I mean, it's the same with the fans of football. There, I think it's still a challenge to see how we do it. But I'm sure that, you know, it's very important to see all the aspects. And one of the aspects of football is for sure experience of the fans. And we will start working on that. Unfortunately, since March, all we do is pandemic. And when this finishes, and again, it will finish soon, we start working on different things, including the inclusion of fans into the decision-making process.
Well, I think, you know, a lot listening will really appreciate that very honest insight you've given there into that particular topic around supporter involvement in decision making in the future. So finally, we're on to the last question now, Alexander. So last year, UEFA awarded one of SD Europe's members from Poland, football club Akersley, the UEFA Grassroots Club of the Year Award. Akersley have been a beacon of democracy and inclusion for Polish football, and there are many clubs like them all over Europe aiming to bring positive change in society through football. We believe that such initiatives are a counterbalance to the ever-growing commercialism of football and contribute to preserving that European model of sport that we've spoken about. What is UEFA's plan to encourage similar work on the bottom, the top, on the bottom and the top of the football pyramid regarding this positive change in society?
Well, grassroots football is for us a very important part of football. We are the governing body. We are not dealing only with A football or top football. It's important to the health of the game. You know, we all started our love affair with the game at that level. Without grassroots football, I'm sure there would be no football. We are working constantly to help national associations ensure that all grassroots football is played in a safe and quality controlled environment. And you know, we are coming back to the Super League here. With Super Leagues of this world, there's no grassroots anymore. There's no football anymore. Grassroots football is especially critical for young children, for their health and their education and general well-being. You know, we don't want children to be on the street. It's better that they play football. We don't want children to be ill. They have to be healthy. They have to do sports. They have to meet different friends. They will meet their friends from other continents, different races, different religions. They will all be friends. Those are values that are much more important than who wins the Champions League, who wins the Euro or the World Cup. So over the next four seasons, we have earmarked 44 million euros to help our member associations fund grassroots activities, a quarter of which will be reserved for UEFA Football in Schools initiative, which is a very, very important initiative. So, trust me, we know what is grassroots. Trust me, we know what is the ecosystem of football. And I think that fans can be a fantastic allies to us to preserve football for all and to stop the greedy individuals to kill it because of their financial interest.
Well, Alexander, thank you ever so much. That was my last question. I really appreciate you taking the time to go through these with us. And once again, thank you for accepting our invitation to speak with SD Europe. So I'd like to, you know, when we speak to everyone we do a podcast with, we invite them to make a closing remark, should mm-hmm. they wish. So the floor is over to you, if you would like to.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask you if I can do that. I would
yes,
like
please.
To speak to all the football lovers around the world, not just Europe, that we should be optimistic. We should learn from this crisis. And if we learn from the crisis, we will come out stronger and smarter. And I promise you all, we will have the good old football with full stadiums back very soon. Happy New Year, Merry Christmas, and enjoy the festive times, although it's a bit special this year.
Well, thanks, Alexander. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Please do listen to the other podcasts in this mini-series in addition to the ones that we've previously published. To find out more information about SD Europe, head to www.sdeurope.eu.